Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
It's time to strap our boots on. This is a perfect day to die. Wipe the blood out of our eyes. Surrender, and there's nothing left for us to do. Find the strength to see this through. We are the ones who will never be broken. With our final breath, we'll fight to the death. We are soldiers, we are soldiers.
Conversation and also part of the Patriot Journalist Network. And if you are a Facebook user, you can find others on the Patriot Journalist Network, such as Mark Prasik's show, which is Full Armor, which you can find weekdays, Monday through Friday, from 8 p.m. till midnight Eastern Time. And the way you can find that is to go to Facebook and in the search engine, simply put Patriot Journalist Network as one word, and you will find the app, and you will find this show, and you will also find Mark Prasik's Full Armor show. And I also like to bring up a couple other shows here, part of the Conservative Conversation, and that is Samuel Sanford Show, Constitutional Conservative Unite, and that is daily from 11 p.m. till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. And then there's also the Rex and Tech Show, which you can find on Friday and Saturday evenings between 8 p.m. and 10 p.m. Eastern Time. Now, tonight, and of course you can find this show, which is Sunday through Thursday from 9 p.m. to 11 p.m., of course, as the others, Eastern Time. Now, tonight we have two very special guests from the Constitution Party, and we will have Floyd Whitley, who is the vice chair of the Idaho Constitution Party, and also Paul Venable, also the from Idaho, who is the state chair. And tonight they will be talking about the Constitution Party and Virgil Good, who is the presidential candidate for the party. And also we will be having folks from the Bard's Logic Political Talks panel, namely Chris, and hopefully we'll also have the opportunity to hear from Rex Christie from the Tex and Rex Show, or the Rex and Tech Show, rather, and also Kelly Mordecai. We're hoping to hear from them also tonight from the panel. So without any further ado, I will let the three gentlemen in. So I'm going to open up the mics to Chris and Mr. Whitley and Mr. Venable. So thank you, gentlemen, for coming into the show. How's everyone doing this evening?
Doing fine.
Great.
We're fine.
And everybody's
thanks.
Live. Okay, great.
Me too. You said gentlemen, so I didn't know if you wanted me to chime in.
Oh, you're a gentleman and a scholar, Chris. Don't try to fool anyone. What I'd like to start off the show with is if one of the two gentlemen they could pick would like to give us more information about the Constitution Party. We'll probably keep it pretty organic, keep it pretty fluid on how you would like to approach that. So go ahead, and then and after that we will have some questions, of course, from Chris and myself. And whoever wants to go first, go ahead.
Oh, I'm going to punt that one to you because we had talked about putting up the history for the listeners and establishing the fact that we are, in fact, a national party. So I think that would probably be you. You're it.
Well, you're probably correct. And so thank you. I figured that I would take the history. The Constitution Party started as a U.S. Taxpayers Party in 1991. It was founded by conservative Howard Phillips, who was who worked in the Nixon administration for a while. And he was our candidate in 92, 96, and 2000. The name was officially changed to the Constitution Party in 99. And our platform is based on the founding documents and its principles, so the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights. Okay. We have I usually avoid using the term conservative because I think it's been somewhat diluted, and so we often refer to as constitutionalists, but sometimes it labels in that we believe in that the power of the Constitution limits the power of the federal government, and in fact, we actually believe that the answer to most of America's problems is staring us right in the face if we would just use it, and that's kind of been pretty consistent with us over time. Now, in more recent news, this year, as you've heard, we have Virgil Good running for as our candidate for president. He was, I believe, a seven-time congressman from Virginia. In 2008, we had Dr. Chuck Baldwin, who is a minister from Florida and recently moved to Montana. And in 2004, we had Michael Peruca. Now, each of those years, we also had each of those years we had a very good showing in some particularly strong states. And when I say a good showing, That doesn't necessarily mean a plurality of votes, but what it does mean is that we're the fastest growing third party in America and continue to be so. And I would imagine with the largest number of registered voters. So that's sort of in a nutshell what our background is or has been for the last since the early 90s. Does that help?
Robert?
Yes, I'm here. No, it's definitely. I'm here, Chris.
I thought you hung up your phone again.
No. I didn't feel my cheeks up tonight, so no, I'm just kidding. Sometimes that happens, but I'm being very careful this evening. So. Yeah, okay, well, Chris, if the other gentleman would like to chime in and say some more about either the Constitution Party itself or if they'd like to tell us more about Virgil Good, who is the presidential candidate, go ahead.
Can you tell us about Virgil and your VP while we're warming up?
Is that you, Paul?
It can be. As I mentioned, Virgil Good has some name recognition as he served in Congress for some terms. He started, Virgil originally ran as a Democrat, and when he didn't necessarily toe the line of the Democratic Party, then he ran as an independent, and has been over the years consistently independent-minded, regardless of what party he was in. And so upon the last election, which he lost to a Democrat, I think within just a few days, he got in touch with the Constitution Party, and he was nominated at a national convention this year in Tennessee and has been pretty much stumping the country since then. Jim Clymer, our vice presidential candidate, has been the chairman of the Constitution Party for the last 12 years. He's an attorney from Pennsylvania, very well-versed in constitutional issues, and essentially has been the voice of the party for the last 12 years.
Really?
I have had the privilege of meeting both Jim and Virgil, and I can attest that they are men of good character and understand the Constitution quite well.
You want me to roll, Robert? Go ahead.
When Virgil Good, not to give the sense of flip-flopping in parties and that kind of thing, but when Virgil Good was switching over to the Independent Party, the reason that occurred is that in 1998, Virgil Good, then a Democrat, voted to support three of the four articles of impeachment against Bill Clinton. And that didn't obviously make him very popular with his fellow Democrats. I think there were only like seven Democrats or in that ballpark that actually voted for that. And so because of that, he was basically disinvited from the Democratic Party, and his alternative at that point was independent. And then he became a Republican. So that kind of helps explain how that transition happened.
Okay, now...
Well, go ahead, Robert.
Go ahead, Chris. No, go ahead.
No, okay. I have... I'm a different nut, and one of the things, I had a really good conversation. Actually, we spent several hours talking, Floyd and I, the other day, and that breaks the ice. It gets to know who you are and why you do what you do and that kind of thing. Paul, how long have you been in the party?
I joined the party in 2004, and that may be an interesting story. I am a recovering Republican, and
that's an interesting way of putting it. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, and I'll explain kind of what happened. Is it's an interesting story. I have excuse me. I had sorry about that.
That's okay.
All right.
And that's what happens when you have organic radio.
There you go.
I have a I was on a full-time traveling assignment. I was on a military contract at the time, and January 20th, 2004. You know what happens every year on January 20th, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's when the president gives a State of the Union address.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
I was in a hotel, which I could see the Capitol Dome from my room, and George Bush was giving the State of the Union address. And I was... it gives me trouble to say this because when he started speaking, he had been my hero for some time, and by the time he was done, I was looking at the television as if to say, "Who are you, and what happened to the guy I voted for?" Okay, because there were two things that he said that surprised me. Okay, and that is, it was giving federal money to faith-based initiatives, which just completely shocked me. I said, "What gives the authority to, you know, to for the federal government to give money to faith-based organizations?" And the other one was, amnesty for aliens. Okay, my maternal grandparents were aliens. They came here from the Caribbean and. And it wasn't an easy road for them. But my understanding is they came to America to be blessed by the fruits of this land, and they worked very hard for that, and they played by the rules. And so this kind of struck me a little deeply. But essentially, the effect of that State of the Union address was like this: it was almost like George Bush grabbing me by the lapels and saying, "Paul Venable, get out of the Republican Party and get out fast." Okay.
Interesting.
What happened to be timely was that we had moved across country the month before. We had moved from Ohio to Utah, and my wife, who had joined the Constitution Party in Ohio, became familiar with the chairman in Utah who is currently now the national chairman, Frank Flueger. And when I came back from my trip, my assignment in Washington, D.C., I met the chairman. Okay. The other thing that happened is while I was there, I happened to be on an email list that Howard Phillips was going to be in Pennsylvania. And so I got in the car. It was a weekend trip. I got in the car, drove in cold Saturday, and he was there. It was Howard Phillips, Alan Keyes, and a guy I'd never heard of by the name of Michael Peruca, who later became our presidential candidate. There were 500 people in this meeting that had very little notice, and it was 27 degrees outside, maybe colder. I'm sorry. No, it was 17. Okay, and I met Michael Peruca. I went home from that meeting and joined the Constitution Party. And when he came to campaign in the state, we had an entourage, a campaign state with him. So it was 2004 when I feel the scales fell off my eyes, and I actually became a member of the party. Okay, it was at the end of 2004. We had by that time we had moved to Utah, moved to Idaho, but that was my introduction to the party, and I haven't, I frankly haven't looked back. In fact, I don't think I could be a Republican or a Democrat ever again.
I got a quick question. Where I'm from Ohio. I'm actually in Ohio now, so it's just out of curiosity for me. What part of Ohio are you from?
Where are you?
I'm in Cincinnati.
You're in Cincinnati? Okay. I grew up in Columbus. We spent our last 8 years in London. You know where London, Ohio is?
Unfortunately, no, I do not, actually. Is that between Cleveland and Columbus?
No, actually, it's about 30 miles west of Columbus and about 7 miles south. So it's okay. Just a town of about 8,000 people. So we lived our last years there. Like I say, I grew up in Columbus. My parents met at Ohio State, and so I have Buckeye in my blood.
Yeah, we've got another person who's part of the conservative conversation called Samuel Sanford. When he comes on when he introduces me when I come onto his show, he's like from the great state of Ohio, and I'm like, well, you know, Sammy, I must say the one great state of Ohio, because they went for Obama in 2004. And I'm sorry, in 2008, and in 2012 they went for Romney. I said, so I don't know about the great state anymore, but I say it kind of in jest, but kind of tongue in cheek. But you know, just if you look at the history, at least recently, of who the state of Ohio has been going for, it makes me just question that. But I digress. A question I have, just to start off before we get to questions, and it's, do you have a website, a general website, either to the Constitution Party or things of that nature, so that the folks could, you know, access it to read more about your platform and things of that nature? And also, if someone could, if Chris, you could do so, if you could put it in the chat, because what I like to do
is get it. I've got all that stuff.
Awesome, great. Just put it in the chat, and what I like to do is on the description part of the archive, because these shows are archived, put a link in the description part, so that anyone who accesses the archive can also access the website through there.
Well, do you guys want the Good for President 2012 or the Constitution Party or both?
You can do both, but the constitutionparty.com is our official national website.
Right.
So you can use that. That's where people can go for information. In fact, they can get information from there about the state parties, about events that we have going on, and about our candidates. So that's a good place to start.
Okay. Sounds great. Well, can I tell you what, Chris, after you put that in, if you'd like to start up the questions, unless there's anything else the two gentlemen would like to add, either Floyd or Paul, before we go into the question section.
Yeah, fill the air for me for a few minutes, guys, so I can put this together and get it in the chat.
Sure. Thank you, Chris. So is there, before we do, as I said, go along with the questions or start off with the questions, is there anything you gentlemen would like to, add, before then?
Well, I would like to say one thing that we are always confronted with, and I think that this has been true really on Chris's Coalition of Freedom site.
Mm-hmm.
We're always asked, if you vote third party, you're throwing your vote away. You can't do that. And I would kind of like to look at the mechanics of that in a way.
Good.
The way I see it is that first of all, you have a crowd behavior, and as we all know, individuals don't act the same way alone as they would in a crowd. And so in some sense, inside of a crowd, like a major party, for example, you have an identity loss. You start to do things, I guess, in a crowd you otherwise wouldn't do. And oftentimes emotion or hostility or anger or a combination of that, because that is known by ideologues and demagogues and that kind of thing, those can be powerful switches, I suppose, for manipulation, if you follow what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
A large crowd, like, say, the Democrat Party or the Republican Party, gives you plausible deniability almost, really, when it comes to selecting your candidates. And so you diffuse your own personal responsibilities of citizenship when you vote with those larger parties, particularly if you're not voting for your principles, but you're voting with the herd. And so what that does is, for an independent or liberty-minded person, it dilutes your vote. It dilutes your voice into a large organization, and once your voice is diluted, it'll never be heard. And that's the distinction, really, between liberty-minded people in a party like ours, is that we refuse to be diluted. Dilution is really a physical thing, a physical property, and it's also a social property in some respects. You start out with a concentrate, and in order to manipulate it and use it, you dilute that. And what has happened with the Republican Party under the Romney people is that they have done in their party machinery what would be illegal to do if they were redistricting people, but the purpose was the same. Their purpose was to dilute the vote, and that's how they got the nomination, if you will. What they did is, instead of redistricting, which is illegal to do, they accomplished the same thing. They compressed conservatives into smaller and smaller boundaries or districts, if you will, and then they isolated them. That's called packing, and that if it were done in an elective district, say, that would be illegal. But really what they did even more than that is they did what is called cracking. They took their opposition, which would have been a minority, the minority conservatives inside the Republican Party, and they spread them thinly across the entire party. And then that way they diluted your voice. And so really what the Republican machinery did is it took the possibility of a conservative voice away from the people in the party.
Mm-hmm. I imagine here's a question for you, and you do not have to answer it in public, but I imagine when you look at the people that were on the ballot, you probably know the ones that were purchased and placed to split the vote.
I think that's pretty obvious. And again, though, when you do that, there's different techniques of doing that. I mean, we talked about it on the phone about a dominant minority. Well, that's what you have with the political establishment in the Republican Party. You have a mm-hmm. dominant minority, and they don't necessarily have to use physical force, but they can use an awful lot of other pressure upon you to get you to agree to dilute your voice. And liberty is not something that you will have or keep if you dilute the voice of liberty. That's just not possible to do.
That makes sense? That was beautiful. Can you type all that out and put it on my group?
Probably not.
That was amazing. And it was so articulate to what we all have conversed about for months, you know, amongst our groups and our shows and things like that. I mean, we are, you know, I can say for myself, you know, I've always known, I mean, we live in a world, Ephesians 6:12, you know, I mean, it's a war, you know what I mean? I've never kidded myself about the world I live in. So, but I have been shocked many times through this primary. I would say early on, I don't remember what it was, but one night I got up and said, with all this weird stuff that went on in Maine and New Hampshire, you know, in those first states, it was just weird, you know, weird reporting and weird reports. And I got online, and I just put election fraud 2012, and I started popping videos and chat, and you know, of course, it all came out of the Ron Paul camp because those young guys and gals, you know, they got the crap beat out of them in 2008, and they were ready for it this time, and they had their video cameras and their iPhones, and I started seeing stuff, and that's when I first, you know, when everybody else was all still fired up about their candidate, when they were still on the platform, I was already going, something's weird going on here, and I didn't understand what it was necessarily. You know, I hadn't clarified that enemy yet, but I knew something was wrong, and I started doing the research, and then I just kind of put it over in a file and went back to the next primary or the next caucus. You know what I'm saying? And then I saw a little bit more, and then I put it in another file, and then I don't know when it was, about midway through or Super Tuesday or something, I was totally convinced that it was totally set up and it was a total fraud, you know, at that point. And it was kind of shocking to me because I kept saying to people in chat, you know, and wherever I was at, Facebook, whatever, I kept saying, we're supposed to be the Republican Party. This is okay over on the other side, because we all know how Obama got elected, or anybody does who did any kind of research or watched the documentaries or anything like that. There, you know, we kind of knew it, but I kind of expected over there. You know, it's just like that statement you said with Virgil Good. He voted on for the impeachment articles on Clinton because it was the right thing to do, and his party kicked him out because he stood on the rule of law. You know, and that's one of the things that, you know what I'm saying? I mean, he did what was right, but his party said, no, what's right is with the party. And I think most of us have that feeling as Republicans that we're supposed to be the Constitution, rule of law, you know, Bill of Rights, you know, God, country, and our guns, you know, like Obama likes to joke around and insult us over. That's how most of us, you guys came to that revelation a little bit sooner than the rest of us. But I sure had that revelation, and I had hints of it during the Bush era, especially when that Patriot Act came out. And No Child Left Behind from the federal government, you know, and you know, like you, like what the heck is a Republican doing this for? But I don't think it clarified. Go ahead.
Well, I was just saying, speaking of that, you know, you're mentioning all these things, and you brought up the platform, and I think that'd be a good place to go right now is to, if they can tell us more about the Constitution Party platform. And if you guys could get as much specificity as you can, we'd appreciate that.
Say that word three times real fast.
Specificity, specificity, specificity.
Paul, I'm cutting.
Nope, no problem. All right. Hang on just a minute. Well, hang on, I stepped away for just a second. You have any specific questions about the platform?
Well, I can answer your state platform question because I'm working on that, as you know, Paul.
Yeah, I know. Hang on just a minute. Let me platform of the Constitution Party, as I mentioned earlier, is pretty much based on the message or the mission of the founders. Okay, and that is the founding fathers. And so I have. The Constitution Party platform is based on the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights, and then what we've done is we have tied each of our platform planks to either the Constitution, the founding documents, or an appropriate quote from the founding fathers. So, and in fact, wouldn't it be nice if when Congress made a law, they would state their constitutional authority that gives them, you know, gives them the right to, or the authority to pass that law. And in fact, when we in 2008, when we deliberately did that, we deliberately tied each plank of our party to the Constitution or the Founding Fathers for that very purpose, to show that there was a constitutional authority for what we were doing. And if we couldn't find it, then we dropped that platform plank. So that's important to know. I was at that convention, and I recalled that Floyd and I were in communications about certain planks that we were in particularly involved with.
How's
Hold
that?
On, Robert. Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah. Hold on. I got like people chatting the heck out of me as I'm trying to stay on track with you guys. Cool. So you want me to roll, Robert?
Yeah, go ahead. If I may ask a first question real quick, Chris. Because I know we had a list, or you had a list, which is great. But one thing that I might have perhaps missed on it, but I do want to touch on it, because a lot of other, you know, of course, one of the first and foremost that people ask about is the economy and jobs. And if you guys could give what the plan would be to, of course, increase the amount of jobs, domestic jobs, you know, here in America, then also, you know, in helping up the economy, bringing up the value of the dollar,
it's
things of that nature.
Yeah. It's
hey, Paul, let me step in here.
Step in there. Step in it.
Just don't step in it.
No, I'm going to try not to.
No. Sorry. Go ahead.
I want to agree with what Representative Ron Paul was saying about a specie-backed dollar, gold and silver.
Right.
But I want to kind of explain that. It's not just a matter of having something for the paper, which
sure.
That's obviously a huge part of it, but it's really more than that. And it's not really even confidence of the people in the currency. The problem we have, of course, is that nobody's confident that the currency we have is worth anything.
Right.
But in the mechanism of the production of bullion to back your currency, that's what I want to focus on kind of briefly. There's a reason why that makes sense. And I want to use an example that occurred here in Idaho. This year, in January of this year, legislators met, and there was a $35 million surplus. And so, being Republican-controlled, of course, they decided they were going to return that money back to the more wealthy people who paid it in. Well, that sounds fair, I suppose, but it's kind of illogical to do that for the following reason. If they collected that $35 million surplus legally, and they did, then they could have used that money for better purpose in the following manner. The state of Idaho and every other state, with the exception perhaps of Utah, who has put this in place, their currency is exposed. Their economy is exposed to the fiat dollar. And so if the federal dollar fails, the economy of Idaho fails, if you will. And so it occurs to me that what should have happened, and I'm going to get to the mechanism of why bullion-backed currency makes sense. If the state of Idaho, for example, took the wisdom of Joseph and a coat of many colors and how he convinced the Pharaoh of Egypt to set aside for times of famine, if the Idaho legislature would have taken the $35 million and said, okay, this is what we're going to do with this surplus, which was legally paid into our treasury. We are going to take this and purchase at market silver and gold bullion to vault it in our state treasury vaults, so long as that silver and gold bullion was mined and converted into bullion here in Idaho with Idaho labor. And we're going to put that in our treasury vaults as an emergency currency. Now, makes sense so far.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the thing about back when William Jennings Bryan was, crucified on a cross of gold and they were attempting to put silver as the basis for the dollar, there was a lot of discussion about this in the progressive era. And one gentleman working with the gold industry was saying that for every gold in the ground is not worth anything. It's just a rock. It's part of a rock. But for every dollar of gold that you convert into bullion, you are at least creating $8 of economic activity.
Right.
And so even if you use that quote from 1908 or 1909 and assume that it's only $8, the $35 million of surplus money that they paid back to those who really didn't need it back necessarily, and they put it in the vaults for emergency currency, they could have created 200 $300 million of economic activity here just in the state of Idaho if they did that. And that stimulates the economy. It stimulates heavy industry, the demand for services. So it's absolutely crucial, really, that we in America, particularly states' rights people or state sovereignty people,
right,
that we must take back at least an emergency measure of prudence and back our own state economies with reserves of bullion. Does that make sense?
Oh, it's beautiful. And can I roll a story off that, not to take us too far off track? But I lived in Alaska for 21 years. I also knew the guy that wrote the Constitution around, or wrote the laws around the oil dividends. And one of the things that he did, because I remember sitting down with him one day and talking about what was the goal of the legislation and the people when they got ready to turn that valve and all that wealth would flow into Alaska. And what they did was, you got that Alaska oil dividends. They set it up in their constitution to where a certain percentage of that dividend has to go into investments, cannot be spent, can't be touched. And it is it requires so many votes to change that law. It was kind of a guaranteed environment to make sure there was always a huge fund of profit in Alaska, as a wealth, like what you're talking about. And so Alaska, what happens is, the money flows, let's say $100 billion, of profits come in the oil. Of course, it's more than that. But anyway, $100 billion comes in, that a certain percentage has to go back into investment. Then out of the balance of the investment, then they had a locked percentage that would go to the state, running the state. And then, of course, there was that Alaska Permanent Fund that was paid out to us that lived there, and put up with the nasty weather. But it's amazing to me how few people in our country, because, I'm old enough to remember my parents getting their first credit card, and they were like, mid-30s, 40s. You know what I mean? People saved money. They didn't go down and get a GMAC loan for 5 years on a car. You went down to your local credit union. You saved up money. You bought things. But it's that whole concept of spend and we'll get more in the future, or the government will give it to us, or we'll tax people more, versus being responsible to the economy and to the people, your voters, and your subjects, whatever you want to call them. But it's amazing to me that Alaska hasn't had any more money go – it's a newer state. It hasn't had any more money go through it than any other state in the union. But why is it debt-free? Because they don't spend their primary investment. They invest their investment. They invest their investment, and then they spend the profits off the investment. And they have safeguards in place to keep politicians from, going hog wild and throwing that money away. And it's common sense economics. And what you're saying is common sense economics is playing it out. And unfortunately, and I say this with a grain of salt, but I probably am right, on a lot of them, is politicians are busy buying votes.
Exactly.
They're busy, and they're too busy buying votes instead of getting busy to the people's business, which is kind of what this whole conversation is about, and getting a chance to get to know this party, getting to know, Virgil, which actually he will be on Sammy's show on Monday, which is really cool. This is a great precursor to that. So anyway, I just wanted to throw that out there because everybody just doesn't get that simple concept. I don't know if that adds to what you were saying, but it's along the same thinking.
And at this time, Chris, if they'd like to chime in on some of the things that you've said, and then we can move over to the question and answer session. I think that's the way I think it'd be good to proceed.
You betcha.
So go ahead, either Paul or Wendy. So if Floyd or Paul would like to chime in on anything that Chris has said, go ahead, and then we'll move over to the question and answer section.
Well, I would prefer just to go to the question and answer session, and
that's fine with me.
We'll try to be brief. No platitudes here.
Okay, I'm ready when you guys are.
go ahead, Chris.
Okay. My understanding right now, with the added state you put on my group last night, you're at 41 states with a merge.
So
here's the question is, why are you not on all 50? It's going to be something people are going to ask, and I guess I'm kind of curious, too, for myself. What is the glitch there? What has got to change? When? You know what I mean?
Let me touch on that for a moment. I had, for example, Jim Clymer, our vice presidential candidate, is from the state of Pennsylvania. Well, there is a legal battle right now in Pennsylvania over parties on the ballot. Okay, part of the problem is that the powers that be in some states simply have made almost insurmountable obstacles for third parties to be available to the people. Okay, Pennsylvania is one of those states. Oklahoma is one of those states. In fact, in Pennsylvania, a third party has to pay a $110,000 fine if their petitions aren't accepted. You know what's up with that? They sued, okay, and that's currently in the courts right now. But at the moment, we're not in the ballot in Pennsylvania, and so. Right. So here we are. We got 41 other states that have given their voters an opportunity to make more than just two choices, and then you've got what I'd say is entrenched power structures that essentially don't. I don't know all of the states that are that very restrictive, but it's been a challenge. The question I would have. Not so much as why aren't we, it's a good question, why aren't we on the ballot more than 41 states, but the better question is, why are we off the ballot in 9 states, and what's happening in those states? Because the Constitution Party actively, parties run candidates for office, okay? So ballot access is painful to achieve, and we do what we can to hold on to it when we get it in various states. And so it's not a small effort to reach out to the people and let this so that they can have the choice to vote for us. All right, it's not a lack of effort on our part, but we do have obstacles in multiple states, and sometimes there may be some states in which we have to fight for ballot access every election. In Idaho, we do not. It's the party paid for ballot access, signature gatherers for ballot access several years ago, over probably about 15 years ago or 12, and we've been able to maintain it. And once we maintain it, then we can keep it. Okay. So, but the best way to answer your question is why are we only in 41 states? Is because we're not for the lack of trying, but that oftentimes we're blocked. And we're blocked by very challenging legal obstacles to make our candidates
immoral but legal.
Can I add something to that?
Yes, sir. Oh, please.
Of course.
Paul touched on that.
Go ahead.
Paul touched on that in that in some states we are on the ballot. When Virgil Good early this year decided to run for the nomination of the Constitution Party, I believe at that time we were on 16 state ballots. But those are the states that Paul was talking about that we have ballot access in and we maintain it. But for third parties in a lot of states, you have to reapply every general election. You're not automatically qualified. It doesn't matter if you ran candidates up and down the ballot. You still have to go about the same process again, gathering signatures to get on that ballot.
Is that true for the main party?
Democrats do not. They automatically qualify. They've arranged it so that they automatically qualify.
Isn't that kind of illegal?
Well, I wouldn't use that strong a language. I would say unethical.
Well, you're a party guy. You can't use that strong a language. I'm a citizen. I can.
Well, and speaking of that, I do have a question, and of course, you know, if you think it's to your detriment to answer it, I understand why. But have you found, or have you been getting any pressure from the Republican Party? Because I've heard
the
of some.
Party?
I'm sorry.
The Romney Party.
Well, yeah, with the Romney Party, sure. Romney Party, Republican Party, whichever, or both. But anyway, because I've heard the Republican Party has been challenging things such as signatures from some of the various third parties. Are you experiencing anything of that nature?
Well, again, we're established in Idaho, so as our state, not, Floyd may be familiar with that in other states, okay? Because he's been doing an outreach, but in Idaho, we have not. Have you picked up on that anywhere, Floyd?
Pennsylvania, you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
But Virginia, yes.
What's going on in Virginia right now?
Yes,
I just saw those articles.
Right.
Well, that, again, you know, stuff gets in litigation, and then it turns into lawyer speak. But the bottom line is they're attempting to keep third parties like the Constitution Party and a qualified, competent candidate named Virgil Goode off of the ballot because they don't want the competition. They've structured ballot access to the point that only two parties automatically qualify, and all other people have to reapply at cost, and they know full well that we, the people, do not have that kind of disposable income. They do because they are the establishment.
I'm going to blow your guys' mind right now. Ready?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, you ever hear of the guy, Richard Gilbert, that filed the delegate lawsuit for the delegates to give people, the delegates, the ability to vote their conscience?
Yes.
Okay, I followed that suit before it was filed, through the filing, through the initial court, through the refiling, up to the appellate court, and it got played around with in the court until when it hit the appellate court, it was a moot point because they drug it out. Even though they're supposed to deal with it in 10 days, they drug it out. But it still can be refiled, but they're changing it because they have so much evidence that they're actually going to run it back to the individual states. But anyway, Richard Gilbert was on another show with some other friends of ours, and he is, and I'm also on, there's a site called Lawyers for Ron Paul that is a Facebook group that I've tracked a lot of things on, but they are in the process right now of refiling. They have all their witnesses, 50 states, and he's going after this thing, this issue of voters' right, the right to vote our conscience. Why is it that some states have the ability to write in so citizens can vote their conscience, and why is it that some, you know, why do they have more rights than other states? Than citizens in other states. So he's going after another lawsuit and he's getting ready to file it. Might be somebody you might want to get to know because he may get lucky here and change this nation in this battle. He's just some crazy libertarian lawyer in California and, you know, willing to get up and go do something nobody else has been willing to do in this country, and that is take these ridiculous rules and unfair rules that actually truly offend the Voter Right Act of 1971, and they really kind of offend several of the filings and rulings that we've had through the years. Now, I'm not a lawyer. I've just been following, you know, the case and the case study and the precedent law. So that might be something we can talk about. You know, I mean, obviously you guys are both in my group, so we can pass that information on to you, but it may be worth getting to know this guy.
Well, give us some questions.
Actually, that's what I was getting to. I'd like to ask the questions that are specifically issued questions. So it looks like we're definitely on the same page and timing here with that.
Cool.
It is about 5 till 10. And I'd like to ask the first one, Chris, and then you want to go ahead, great. It says, what is your position on returning states their proper power, and how would you do it?
You want me to do that one, Paul?
We both might have some ideas on that. Why don't you start, and maybe I'll follow up. We, you know, our platform addresses that to some degree, but...
It does.
Yeah. Well, in fact, go ahead. You want me to start? Where do you want to go, Floyd?
let me just say, for instructive purposes.
Okay.
Obviously, the victors write the histories.
Mm-hmm.
And the Federalists, the consolidation government guys, they wrote the histories. They won. The anti-Federalists, and that kind of takes a bad connotation today, but they really did not want a consolidated government with the powers, with uncontrolled powers. Now, we can sit and say, well, anti-Federalists, those are bad guys, but yet these are the very same guys that provided the American people with the Bill of Rights. Had it not been for them, you would not have a Bill of Rights. And so, again, back to the instructive purposes here, I think many people mistake the concept of government greatly. I think Chris and I talked about this earlier. If you were to ask the common American average guy, what are the three branches of government? Invariably, they're going to tell you the executive, the Congress, and the courts. That's what they will say. But that is actually factually wrong. That's not true. And you can look at our at Amendment 10 and see that what I'm going to tell you is true. There are three branches of government, yes. One of them is the federal government. One of them is the state government. And the third branch of government in our system is the people. Those are the three branches of government. So when you start talking about extending rights to the states, that's an issue. 17th Amendment needs to be corrected and that kind of thing. Paul may have something to step in on that.
Well, that's the 17th Amendment was what I was considering, and how to make that happen. You know, the mechanics of it, we still work on. But you know what? Essentially, what the 17th Amendment did was made senators simply longer-term representatives. Okay?
Okay.
The way the Constitution was written, the Congress were the representatives of the people, and the Senate were the representatives of the states, and that was one of the major debates in the Constitution Convention, is how the representation would be divided up, okay? And so that was it. In fact, it was called the Connecticut Compromise, and it was a balance between representation or equal voting by states, and that's what they came up with. So what happened is, and here's where the rights of states were. Here is where the federal government managed to turn states into the equivalent of counties, okay? Because the senators used to be accountable to state legislatures who chose those representatives, and let me give you an example. Let's say the president, let's say Congress, constitutionally declares war. Okay? Now, until that time, ideally, there isn't a commander-in-chief. But once there is, the Senate, as the state's representatives, once they voted, okay, and the people voted, okay, for this congressional declaration, it opened the door for the state to allow their militias to be sent to war. Okay?
Wow.
And with the people being concurrent, you know, that opened the door for a president becoming commander in chief. So that's one example. But essentially, states have become vassals of the federal government because we don't have that voice as states, and so what happens is federal programs get pushed on states when you have, excuse me, because we're turning more into a democracy, okay?
Yep.
Because
we're voting
by popular election for senators instead, and these are supposed to be. This is a different type of representative, okay? Because it commits the states when done properly. So it's a platform plank that the 17th Amendment is something that needs to be at the least revisited, but at best undone.
Interesting. Well, I hope. Our buddy Kelly's listening to this stuff. Amazing. You ready, Robert? Did I lose him?
Yeah.
We'll just roll in. Okay. So, all right.
Yeah, if you want to move into the next question, Chris,
okay,
go ahead.
Great. So let's just talk while we're on this issue. Let's just roll down with the economy and creating jobs and creating that, well, you don't create jobs, but creating that environment to help produce jobs and roll a very important second point. Even, you know, we've all become much more aware of the Fed this election cycle because of Dr. Ron Paul. And so many of us, you know, I think we're all more aware of the abuse and the insanity of it. So what's the party's take on that? And, you know,
If Floyd, if you don't have something for that, I do, okay. And certainly chime in if I'm a little off base.
Okay.
It's tied to the question you asked a little earlier, and that is, how can you expect to win? Let me share something with you. Federal spending has accelerated since 1960, regardless. Which party is in office, in the executive branch or the legislative branch, it has failed to go down. Okay, so the question I would ask, you know, how can you win? Okay, is what relevance does it make if a Democrat wins or Republican wins if after every election the people lose?
Right.
Here's my point. Okay, we're offering a choice. Okay. From what they're seeing in terms of our rampant federal spending going out of the pockets of the people. That's what we're seeing today. Do you realize that right now there a third of Americans are on welfare? Did you know that? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Shuck. I read that like last week and I was stunned. So what I mentioned earlier was that, you know, like Dorothy and his glass slipper and her glass slippers in The Wizard of Oz, we've got there. We're just not using it. Okay, and we have the answer in the Constitution. Here it is. And here in Article One, Section 8. You're probably familiar with this. It gives Congress the authority to coin money, regulate the value thereof, a foreign coin, and fix the standards of weights and measures. Okay. Now, when you mention the Fed, I imagine that most of your audience understands that, you know, the central bank, which was created in 1913, somehow the Congress abdicated control of the money of its money authority.
Right.
Now, you will never, ever, 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 ever have a balanced budget or monetary control as long as the people, through their representatives, do not control their money. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Any talk you hear about a balanced budget, amendment, or federal spending of any kind is theater, simply because the people are in control of money. The founders made it really clear there are two things they were concerned about, okay? And one of them was that the value of the currency should never ever be debased. Okay, the Fed's done that, and that is the very very reason why we're in our position today. Okay, and so that's one thing. Okay, you know that with it's and that is the power. The power has been taken out of the people's hands because, as you know, okay, the Fed's not accountable. Apparently, they've hardly ever been. Have they even been audited once since their existence? Okay.
And Virgil Goode stands square with Ron Paul on that issue. He is calling for an audit of the Fed, and I do too. And this country boy says, open the vault and put your hands on every single one of those gold bars that are supposed to be in that vault.
Yeah,
this is a big issue. I mean, I don't know how this is going to be unfolded. I don't know if Congress has the will to act or the cojones to take this to power. I mean, every one of these guys is bought and paid for by somebody. I mean, you know, it's that same thing. Can one man change this? Hmm?
The two parties will never do that.
That's
they have
true.
No incentive to. There's no incentive built into their system for them to do any kind of change. They may swap who rides in the front and who rides in the back, but basically they're going the same place.
Can a third-party president enact change in this environment on this?
A third-party president can do a lot in some cases by not doing. Let me give you an example.
Okay.
The president is responsible to execute law. Okay.
Right.
If a third-party or constitutional president looks at the Constitution and says this law is not constitutional, okay, now, you know, one, he's either not going to sign it, or two, it's already in place, I'm not going to execute this law. I'm not going to spend any money on it. He has the power, as much power not to do as he has to do.
Interesting.
And so that's something that to keep in mind. So okay. Absolutely, yes. Ideally, the president isn't necessarily supposed to be, the federal government is not supposed to be so large in our minds that it's taking up the time it's taking up with us now. But if a third party candidate, and particularly a Constitution Party candidate like Virgil Goode, stands in the office of president, okay, there are, even with a Congress that's not necessarily on his side, okay, he can choose not to and stand up with the Constitution, and if the people stand up behind him, then you'll get somewhere.
Okay, can I put a quote? Can I follow up on that?
Go ahead and follow up on that, and then I've got another question for a different issue, so go ahead, guys.
Cool.
Okay. I posted this, I believe, on Chris's site, and it is basically hitchhikes on what Paul just said, standing upon principle. Machiavelli, we get a bad connotation from him, but he was actually a very astute politician or a theorist in politics anyway. He said the following thing, and this was in the 1400s, a return to first principles in a republic is sometimes caused by the simple virtues of one man. His example has such an influence that the good men strive to imitate him, and the wicked are ashamed to lead a life so contrary to his example. So you ask me, can a third-party president change? Yes, he can. He can change this country based on his virtues and his principles. That was it.
Interesting.
Okay, so I'd like to go to another question here, and this has to do with Obamacare. How would, going forward, how would your deal with your, you know, the party deal with Obamacare, and what would be the solution to replace it and deal with the health care crisis?
Paul, let me have this.
Take it.
I would submit that the entire plan, and I said this at the time, and a lot of Democrats were saying, oh, you're just an Obama basher. No, the plan they have made no sense. And it occurs to me that they could have done something much better. And there was this is also ancillary to stimulating the economy, in fact, if you'll stay with me here a second. In these United States, we have approximately 3,700, I think, somewhere in that neighborhood, of counties. And the counties, I believe, as a constitutionalist, are the bedrock foundation of our republic. But given the amount of money that Obama and Pelosi and Reid and all those poured into this program, it would have made far more sense if the purpose of their health care proposal, and now law, if it was to actually distribute health care to the underprivileged, the working poor, and so forth, those who could not afford it. It would have made a whole lot more sense to give $100 or $150 million to each and every county in our land and have that county, who is already managing the welfare and the Medicare and all those types of programs, the social programs, and let them build a state-of-the-art county health care facility. Now, just think about had they done that. You talk about shovel-ready jobs. Well, there you go. If every county in this country had $150 million to build a state-of-the-art health care facility and put it under the programs that already exist, look at the jobs just to build those. And so in my view, you know, I don't want to get in partisan bickering, but it seems to me we need to be a little bit more thoughtful in what we are passing through our Congress, and Paul hit on that. It's not what you do. Sometimes it's what you don't do.
Interesting.
Well, folks, we got about 17, 18 minutes before the bottom of the hour, in which we're going to have some folks from the chat and for folks to call in with questions that they may have. So, Chris,
right.
If there's any pressing questions that I know that you know that you would like to have gotten out tonight,
let's go ahead and deal with those.
Yeah.
Let's hit the top things. You know, obviously, the economy is a huge issue, and I would assume, you know, you guys can hit on that. I would assume, you know, that another issue is, you know, the debt and balancing the budget.
Right.
You know, these are key things. You know, illegal immigration. And then, you know, hit those components, and then really I want to get the Virgil Good Constitutional Party take on our foreign policy, our endless wars, our meddling in the rest of the world versus being effective in the rest of the world, because this is really becoming a point where people are going, what in the heck is our government doing out there? So that's kind of a slew of things.
This is, let me touch on something in terms of the economy that maybe it's not apparent to everyone, but ought to be, okay? It's because it's one of those things that's kind of staring at us and they really don't see it. I was in the last election, I was helping some campaign stops up in North Idaho, and it is a heavy, heavy timber area, and a lot of the people I spoke to, there was a candidate up there for county assessor, and he was telling me about the depressed area and how loggers are out of work. And I said, well, answer a question for me. Where are all these logs going from on these trucks that are passing by me on the road? Here's what he said to me. He said, they're coming from Canada. I said, I don't understand. You have all of that timber in North Idaho, and we are importing our timber from Canada. Here's something I want to share with you, you know, chew on for a minute. Let me give you a concept. Let's say that wealth comes out of the ground, all right? But you have, in many areas of the country, federal land, especially federal lands, especially wildlife refuges, and I'm not saying that we shouldn't protect wildlife, but what I am saying is that when you lock up the ground from mining, manufacturing, agriculture, and other things that people use to make their living, then you're going to break an economy. What happens is we're not making things. But I think part of the answer, you know, to the economic problem is production. Okay, and we have we've got an issue in we've got a representative in Idaho who is addressed, who's kind of effectively addressed issues, and that's say, you know, you liberals want more taxes, but you've got to let go of the ground so that we can may have production so that people can pay taxes. Because at this point, I've never seen anything like this. You know, our parents and grandparents grew up in the Depression, and they saw soup lines. My father told me about people in soup lines, okay? There are people today in soup lines, but you don't see them, okay, on the corner with a bowl begging for soup. You see them, you hardly see them, but they're there. Okay, a third of us are on welfare. But the point I want to make is that the environmental lobby has done such a good job of locking up the ground in the United States that in North Idaho, we still need timber, by the way, but North Idaho is coming from Canada. We've done such a good job of locking up the ground in the United States that so many of our imports now, what can you find now that doesn't have a Made in China label? I'll give you an example. Right. I like fish. Okay, I could eat fish every day. I can't even find fish in the store that isn't imported from China anymore. Okay,
you gotta be careful about that then.
Okay, and so my point is that manufacturing, production, hear me, production. If production grinds to a halt, we stop making things in the United States, then we don't have anything to even base a service economy on.
Right.
And so we have to unlock the ground to mining, okay, to timber, to fisheries, to agriculture, to anything that builds wealth. I mean, I'll tell you, wealth being built right now in North Dakota. There's so much work in the oil fields in North Dakota, they don't need places for those people to stay. All right?
Yep.
So you see what I'm saying? There are mineral rich states, there are resource rich states, but the ground is being locked up, okay? And people can't do work if the ground's locked up. They have to go to service jobs, okay?
Well, and let me roll
real
into
quick,
that, and also
Chris, real quick. I just want to announce and introduce another member of the Barnes Logic panel, and he is also a host for a Blog Talk radio show, which is the Tex and Rex Show, and I believe I'm having him on the line, and that is Rex. Go ahead.
Hey, guys. Sorry I haven't been able to listen. I was actually running the Tex and Rex Show, and we had attorney Richard Gilbert on talking about his efforts to allow write-ins so that people can vote their conscience as opposed to stuck with the statist options in every state. And thank you for being here, and I'll just go about your conversation, and I'll chime in if Robert calls on me.
Cool. So I guess go ahead, Robert.
That wasn't me. I think that was either Floyd or Paul.
Well, shoot us some questions. Let's cover some ground.
I had done some commentary on the economy, and so someone was going to respond to that, I think.
Yeah, I was going to add to that, and I guess let me roll that into action-based stuff. You know, where what you gave as an answer is true, and there's also another truth is we don't make anything anymore. You know, money and wealth in this country was made because it's like when you bring ore out of the ground, you know, if you take it all the way to a paperclip, you know, it's the highest rate of return because of all the processes of manufacturing from A to Z. Well, you know, that has been, you know, shipped overseas for a long time. So what is the Constitution Party or Virgil's attitude about giving us back the right to build and manufacture and do things in this country?
Let me answer.
Go for it.
In some cases, better handling, I don't know whether I would call it manipulation, but certainly better legislation in our trade agreements would go an awful long way. And yet another example, we tend to use Idaho as an example for everything. Maybe it isn't, but where I live, not only is timber important, but so is agriculture, farming, wheat particularly, dry land wheat. As a matter of fact, what we have here is the most, between the Camas and the Palouse, the most productive wheat land on earth, not just in the United States. And so what has happened is our trade policies, and I could go into some specifics, not necessary here, but in essence, our farmers are commodity producers of wheat. They are paying to truck it down to the port of Lewiston, which is links up to the Columbia River, and it's barged, and the barge takes it down to Columbia and across the Pacific Ocean to markets in Asia, primarily China and so forth. But look at the value that we're giving away by permitting that kind of trade. What we're doing is we're locking our farmers into commodity production, and they will never realize the full economic value of their labor and their commodity wheat, because what we're doing is we're permitting that wheat to go over to China to be milled into flour and value-added goods rather than doing it here. And so right. If you want to look at holistic type of economies and even environments and communities, it seems to me that it would make more sense for us to mill that wheat here. I mean, within 5 miles of where I'm at, and if the Chinese want our products, then how many bags of flour do you want? And I think the old timers knew this. Yet another example locally, our county paper is called the Idaho County Free Press. It was established by a gentleman named Aaron F. Parker. He was a Englishman, actually, came over, fought in the Nez Perce Wars and so forth, an instrumental man in writing the Constitution.
Uh-oh.
Something's happening here. They just dropped the call.
It's that Echelon program.
Well, they also said that there's a lot of particulate matter going on from some kind of fire that's down the way. At some kind of perhaps they'll call in some kind of creek or something like that. So hopefully they'll be able to call back in. But at this time, we also have what I believe is the other host of the Tex and Rex show, and I believe this is the Tex part, the Rex and Tex show, and this is the Tex part. And I believe the gentlemen are calling back in, at least one of them did. So let me try to open up the mic here. There we go. Yes, the gentleman called back in. So, Tex, is that you?
Yes, it is, Robert. Happy to be calling in. Sounds like
Great.
You're having a good show.
Great. Thank you very much. Go ahead, and here's how I'd like to do this. Rex is here as well. So, Rex, we've been talking about, you know, the economy and things of that nature.
So if you have any other questions for the two gentlemen, they are back in. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for calling back. And then if you'd like to chime in, Rex, and then Dan, if you've got any questions. And if it's a redundant question, we'll just move on to something else. So go ahead, Rex. And
yeah.
We do have Floyd and Paul back in here.
Okay. Well, gentlemen, thanks for being here. Forgive me if I'm being redundant, but like I said, I missed the first hour because we were broadcasting our Tech and Rex show. But one of the things that obviously is of chief concern to anybody who understands economics is the Federal Reserve. And I think that's one of the reasons why Ron Paul had such a prominent showing in the Republican Party. In fact, he had enough delegations to be nominated on that first ballot until they stole the nomination. So barring those who are going to write in Ron Paul either as a protest or in states that allow it, and if Richard Gilbert's lawsuit goes through, maybe more so, how does Richard Gilbert, how does Virgil Goode attract disaffected Ron Paul and perhaps even Gary Johnson voters, especially, you know, vis-a-vis the economy, but especially regarding the Federal Reserve? And would you consider Virgil Goode a subscriber to the Austrian Economic School?
You want that, Paul? Or
I thought that you might take that, Floyd.
Well, first of all, I'm a little uncomfortable putting words into Virgil Goode's mouth. But he has agreed in the past. I think I had a quote somewhere where Virgil Goode said early this year, I think it was in April, that of all the legislators and the president's men and so forth that are in Washington now, Ron Paul is the only one who has the will to cut spending. And Virgil and Ron Paul are fairly close on their concept of the Federal Reserve and the need to audit the Fed and control it. I think you would find that question would be better directed to Virgil, though, because I don't want to put words in his mouth.
Oh, sure. No, I understand, and let me qualify that. I don't expect you to speak for Mr. Goode. I just was hoping that you would share, let's make it clear, your opinion of how he might go about do that or how we might go about, you know, doing that, attracting those disaffected Ron Paul voters who feel that the nomination was stolen, and even perhaps some Gary Johnson voters, given the fact that it seems – And I don't want to disparage him in any way, but that he might be playing politics lately by trying to attract Obama voters and perhaps alienating some true conservatives. And how would we go about getting those voters behind Virgil Goode? I mean, obviously they're fairly close in economics, and the Constitution Party platform, especially vis-a-vis economics, is fairly close to Ron Paul or even, you know, a libertarian ideology, but there are some significant differences, especially the fact that the platform bases itself on Christianity. Am I correct?
That is in the preamble of the platform, yes.
Which would be very attractive to, you know, say, Newt Gingrich supporters or Michelle Bachmann or even Rick Perry, who may feel that they have to hold their knows and vote for Romney, but you know, we have a great candidate here who's right with them on social issues and right with Ron Paul supporters on economic issues, which makes him, you know, very well rounded. So I'm just trying to figure out how to pull those people and what we can tell them, because, you know, people always have concerns when they first hear of somebody. Now, as a Virginian, I'm slightly more familiar with Virgil Goode than your average, you know, American, but for some of these people, this is the first time that they hear his name is when you bring it up. So what can we tell them to, you know, give them something to sink their teeth into?
Well, let me suggest something. First of all, I think we're already seeing it, okay? I think we're seeing, for example, I keep tabs on the number of registered voters in Idaho, and that number from the primary, from the Idaho primary to the week of our state convention, it was the last week in August, our registered members of the Constitution Party jumped by 25%. I think we're starting to see it already, that people are looking for somewhere to go because the blatant behavior that they saw that at the Republican National Convention and even during the primaries was almost as if to say, I think there was an article in the National Review, okay, that Ron Paul, you're really not welcome here. And so, in a sense, they're almost helping, the Republican Party has helped to drive people to look for other options. Now, what are we doing to get them? Everything we can. We have, we believe we have a candidate that speaks to the principles of limited government, and as Floyd pointed out, is reasonably closely aligned with Ron Paul and his viewpoints on economics. We have a work to get the word out, and if I can share something else with you, we've had a little more help from the press in this year.
Really?
When Chuck Baldwin ran for president in 2008, he was told point blank by the major media, you know we're not going to cover you. That's a quote. Okay? He got 45 seconds on Lou Dobbs. For one reason or another, we're getting a little more press with Virgil Goode. But it's also our job to get the word out as effectively as we possibly can. And in a party that doesn't, first of all, we don't take federal money as a party. Okay, we don't take federal matching funds. So what we have to do is be very frugal and very effective with fewer resources than the major parties. So it certainly is a job. Okay, but that's what we're up to.
I have a question to add to Rex's question. It's very important, especially when we talk about Paul supporters. So whenever I can.
Okay, sure. I'd like to give Tex an opportunity to chime in with a question if he has one, and then yes, definitely after Tex, then go ahead, Chris. But Tex, what you got?
Yeah, I would just say that. I think, you know, kind of in the popular perception, a lot of people, they view the Libertarian Party as the, of all the third-party candidacies, the Libertarian Party is the next up-and-comer. But Gary Johnson really shot himself in the foot. I think apparently everyone is trying to be an appeaser this election season, and he, you know, made some statements that I don't think will help him. If anything, they will hurt him, which, you know, the Constitution Party is one of the other sort of people in the third party, I don't know, universe that also has a pretty good following. So I was just curious. I know you guys have a strong level of support in Virginia. You're talking about Idaho. So I was just wondering kind of where do you consider your main basis of support in terms of states and that kind of thing, just so I can kind of get a better sense of where you're located.
Floyd may have some statistics on that. I would say from year to year, that's hard to say. I'll tell you something else that I've observed. I mentioned something about registered members of the Constitution Party, but something else that plays out that was a kind of surprise to me is that we get a lot of independent or unaffiliated voters. I'll give you an example. There are maybe 400 registered members of the Constitution Party of Idaho, but our Lieutenant Governor candidate in 2010 got 20,000 votes. Okay, over, by several orders of magnitude, more than the registered voters, and so it's hard to tell where that is. I think people discover it's just like I discovered the Constitution Party and haven't looked back since. When people discover something that addresses their principles and the issues drive them our way, you know, it boosts our visibility. Okay, I don't want to use the term popularity because we've been pretty consistent about our principles and our issues. Okay, so we haven't necessarily been popular, but it boosts our visibility and our the interest of people in the party and our support. So, don't know if I can point to.
Let me put some numbers on you.
I kind of understand exactly what you're saying, and I just want to say that I actually read your party platform, which is run something like 20-plus pages, if not 30, and I thought it was very good. It's very, you know, you're the Constitutional Party, so it gets right back to the constitutional principles, and I thought, you know, this is a very interesting party and definitely something I'm willing to consider and look at more. And
sure.
Certainly as a replacement to the Republican Party, which basically just sold me out. So, you know, I need people who stand on principle.
Can I interject some numbers here for you?
I think
one of the things that many people misassume about the Constitution Party is that we're just a post office box and a printer. That's simply not the case. We are a national party. We run candidates every election up and down the ballot in a host of states. Now, I'm going to read some of these off to you, if you will, please. You asked, where is our support at? Well, in Missouri, we have a very competent and qualified candidate in Cynthia Davis, the lieutenant governor, but we're also running two U.S. representatives, a state representative, and a sheriff in Missouri in the Constitution Party. In Michigan, we're running a U.S. senator, Richard Matkin, and five U.S. representatives. In Nevada, we have a U.S. Senate candidate under the Constitution Party, David Vanderbilt. We have four. We have four U.S. representatives running in Nevada, county commissioners up and down the ballot, state senators. In Pennsylvania, we have a state auditor running, Robert Goodrich, state treasurer, Donna Fike, state representative. South Carolina, four state house members, three U.S. representatives, city councilmen, and so forth. So, you know, who is our base, and are we being supported? I don't know, but we are a national party, and we are running for real in states across the country. Thank you.
No, beautiful. Can I roll off? Are you ready for me to roll off the,
go ahead, Chris.
Second part of Rex's question? One of the hotbed issues in especially for Paul people, and becoming more and more for the rest of us conservatives, new people, and everything else, is the revelation that we've learned from Ron Paul. Not that we agree 100% on his foreign policy, but we got 900 bases around the world. We got nonstop wars. We've got a president that can, you know, launch wars, you know, the War Powers Act, and uses it at will, that can kill people, you know, with the stroke of a pen. You know, conflicts in Iran that, in Syria, that after watching Egypt and the other three or four countries fall to the Muslim Brotherhood, we're kind of wondering what the heck America is doing in terms of foreign policy and aid to our enemies, and getting ready to start another war, you know, that, and which really gets us in trouble because, you know, those states are those Middle Eastern states are backed by China and Russia, and it just seems like we're kind of broke, tired. Our machine, our military machine, is dysfunctional, frustrated. That's why Ron Paul has such a high following of military people, because they're starting to go, you know, I don't know if America is the good in the world anymore, and we need somebody who's got a vision to pull us back. Now, and I want to preface this, it's really important because, you know, us four here on this program, we come from that Newt background. So, you know, we've heard Newt talk about foreign policy is absolutely messed up, and it needs to be revisited, and everybody's looking at the wrong enemy and not looking at the ones we need to be looking at. and you know, saying we're running off the Cold War. So what's Virgil's, you know, vision for our solving some of these problems, you know, from foreign aid to wars? And NDAA is a very important one to add on there, too. I know he's against it, but go ahead.
Well, Virgil Goode, first of all, and I agree with this, and this is going to be straight conservatism. It's crystal clear, and it dates back to Barry Goldwater and that particular period of time. He's basically saying it's time to shut the United Nations down, or at least shut down the United States' involvement in the United Nations. In fact, and again, I don't want to put words in his mouth, sure, but he is calling really for removing the United Nations from sovereign soil of these United States. And I think that in many respects, that's part of what you're saying. The United Nations, it might have been a nice-sounding idea, but it's basically worked against us.
Mm-hmm.
And we are now fighting wars for it, the United Nations. We pay 26-27%, whatever that is, of the entire United Nations budget, and then those people turn around and use the United Nations against us. And not only that, our sons and daughters are fighting, really, not for American commanders, but for foreigners. And this is wrong.
Mm-hmm. Can that be done?
That was just my piece on part of the thing that I understand about Virgil Goode. And in some cases, what that really means is we have to look at some of the treaties that we have. I mean, if we passed a treaty, then certainly we can revoke the treaty. And that's a matter of the people taking control of their representatives in Congress, get off the two big box parties, and actually have a representative, whether that representative is a Green Party candidate or not.
Speaking of the United Nations, when are we going to realize that we legitimize the United Nations? Right?
Exactly.
By being part of it, we legitimize it. Now,
exactly.
I'm not saying pull out of the Security Council, because the Security Council has certain authorities in the world that, you know, are special, but quit funding this thing. Kick them out of New York. Get the hell out. Just being part of the Security Council doesn't mean you have to have an office in New York. Go to hell. You know, why don't you guys go meet in Baghdad? You know, I don't care where you meet. Just get out of here. But the United Nations is us. Because they have no military, they can't do anything. Everything happens at the Security Council. We decide at the Security Council, right? Us, China, Russia, France, UK, basically make the decisions, right? But even if France, the UK, Russia, and China all wanted to do something, they can't do it because they don't have the military power to do it. They rely on us, and they need our money to accomplish all of this stuff. It's the same thing with NATO. NATO is a fig leaf to Europe to pretend that Europe actually is a military power when they're not. NATO is the United States, and it's the UK. The UK basically brings, they're like two divisions of the U.S. military now. It's essentially, it's what the UK is. All those other militaries in Europe, I don't know, maybe they have tanks, maybe they don't. Maybe they have a piece of metal, and they call it a tank, and look, it's got tank treads on it, and we have, you know, a pipe sticking out of the top of the turret, so it looks like a tank, but it doesn't function like a tank in battle. It's an ancient tank, you know? We pay for all of this stuff, and what does the United Nations do? They bite the hand that feeds them. They put terrorists in charge of the Human Rights Council. They openly mock us. At what point do you just say, look, screw you guys, we're not doing this anymore. This isn't an organization. This is a dysfunctional family.
Does Virgil have the wherewithal to take this on, in your opinion?
I believe so.
Okay, that's fair. What about this whole thing of our personal sovereignty being sold down the drain with NDAA and the Patriot Act and drones and people wondering when they're going to be stuck in an internment camp because the government decides we're terrorists because we're having conversations about states' rights.
Yeah, and actually, Kelly Mordecai, let me chime in real quick, Chris. Normally Kelly Mordecai, another member of the panel, would be in tonight to definitely address something like that as well. But unfortunately, he had other things he had to attend to. He's got a court case that he's working on with the federal grand jury that he had to get some paperwork. And by that, so that's why he was unable to make it tonight. But if any of the two gentlemen would like to answer that question, go ahead. I just wanted to let people know some folks might have been wondering where he was this evening. And I know that
where's Waldo?
He said to me that's what he's working at. I'm sorry?
Where's Waldo?
Where's Waldo? Yeah, where's Kelly? No, but he's working on a case. That's why he was unable to make it. But, the two gentlemen, whether Paul or Floyd, like to speak on that. Go ahead.
What was the question again?
Well, the question is we're losing, we're becoming, we have this whole NDAA thing, and it's hovering over citizens that came out of the Patriot Act, that came from a Republican, and we've given up, we're just about become a totalitarian nation under this document. And all the facts, all the spinoff things, it's all about the terrorism, it's all about this, but we know it's not about that. We're losing our personal sovereignty. What's Virgil's, position on this, and what's the Constitution and Party position on this? I mean, Romney loves it. Obama loves it. We hate it as citizens. What's Virgil's position? There we go.
Well, that I know of, he wouldn't ever support anything like that. And part of the reason you have this problem, and I think that went back to Kelly, if I understand, yesterday did a state sovereignty
right.
show.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's part of the problem. Patrick Henry, back when they were arguing about ratification of consolidation into a more powerful central state, federal state, he basically warned the people, particularly in the Virginia debates, that the only thing really that exists between you and the federal consolidated government being a tyrant, the only thing between you that can guarantee your liberties and freedoms is the state. That's the only mechanism or tool for protection of the citizens, if you get right down to it, against a tyrannical federal government. And that's why I wanted to point out that the three branches of government, if people picked this up and held it close to their hearts, there are three branches, the federal government, the states, and the people. And the federal government went a long way to removing the protection of the people by getting rid of the states. At least, you may have nostalgia. There's a Delaware and maybe there's a Iowa someplace. But the reality is, as Paul pointed out, these are no longer sovereign states. And so to get to resolving what you're talking about, Chris, we have to return to a state-led republic. That's the only solution. That's the only protection we have.
That's the constitutional solution. Yes, that is quite correct. Now, how to effectively get there? It's an interesting question. I think that the people have to hear. Let me give you something that I perceive that I think one of the reasons that Ron Paul was consistently over and over elected in his district was because his constituents understood the principles of liberty. Even when they tried to gerrymander his district, he continued to get reelected. And he was in Congress as long as he wanted to be, because his people reelected him. So let me suggest something to you, and it may upset some of your listeners, okay? But people who think members of the Constitution Party and liberty-minded people don't have the luxury of being elected by an ignorant populace. What needs to happen, I believe, is people need to understand the principles of liberty and then be willing to stand up for them. And so you got a Congress that's unresponsive to people. And the reason they're unresponsive is because the people don't know their liberty well enough to tell them to straighten up or get out. You know, we have, you know, when their behavior performs out of step with our standard of liberty, then we the people have the obligation to educate them, or we have the duty to remove them. And we've been short-sighted as a people. And so I'll give an example. Congress, a popular thing to do these days, well, since Lincoln, has been executive orders, okay, reaching beyond the executive branch, okay. Another popular thing to do has been signing statements since Bush, okay. Now, what's the Constitution say about legislation? It says all legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States, which shall consist of a Senate and a House of Representatives. So what does our Congress do when the President or the courts try to legislate? These branches or these divisions are expected to jealously guard their powers, and they just stand by as if, oh, the President, you know, did a signing statement. No.
Yeah.
That here's what happens, okay? The moment that happens, the Congress needs to stand up and says, you don't have the authority to do that. As Congress, we're telling you it's null and void. Okay. Now,
right.
But for the Congress to be able to do that, the people have to know that. Okay.
And be educated.
And if I can say anything to our audience and to the people, that is, pick up a constitution, read it. You can do it in one sitting, and then apply that as a standard to what's happening in government today, and tell me if you like it. Because the Declaration of Independence said these words. It says, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that to preserve these rights, governments are instituted by the consent of the governed. I may have gotten that wrong, but if what is happening to our – if the creature has – gone above the Creator, and what is happening in our government is not to our consent, then we need to understand that. Do we have a couple more minutes? I got to tell you another story.
Well, unfortunately, we only have about 7 minutes left here, and we've got five folks on the line. So, what I'd like to do is, you know, give each person a minute to, you know, finish off for the evening. And, of course, I mean, if there's some things that have been left unsaid on the show, we would like to have you guys come back another time if you'd like.
Oh, yeah.
That would be great. And then what I'd like to do is start with Rex and then Pax, and then go ahead with the Chris and then the other two gentlemen to finish things off on the last one which we got. And just to remind the audience that Pax and Rex have a show live tomorrow between 8 p.m. and 10 p.m. Eastern Time, and I'm sure it'll be a great show. So go ahead, Russ.
Thanks, Robert. I don't want to belabor a point too much, but at this stage of the game, I'm being a very real political pragmatist. I can without a doubt say that the Constitution Party platform expresses my values more than any other, and I believe that Virgil Coode is the candidate that I prefer, and if I'm strictly voting my conscience, I'm going with Virgil Coode. But as far as how I'm looking at this right now, my contention here is that Romney's going to lose, and what I want to do is beat Obama too. So how what is the strategy to make sure that we can get everybody behind Virgil Coode, who are considering Gary Johnson or writing in Ron Paul? Because I think that the Liberty candidates are going to catch a majority. I just don't want to see it split, you know, three, four, or five ways. And what can we do to help in that effort?
You want that, Paul?
You know, I have, you can continue to speak out on radio shows like this one. We can continue to do everything in our power, but what I will share with you is something that our candidate Michael Peruca said when he ran in 2004, is the duty is ours and the outcome is God's. It's our founders had ran an insurmountable, we should not have beat the most powerful military force on the planet at the time. Okay? We were fighting a losing battle. We won. All right? We may be fighting a losing battle, okay, but the duty is ours to perform, and we may not have all the answers, but we need to do all that's in our power to do what we can. Okay, this may not be, you know, the all-encompassing answer that you're looking for, but we need to stand up and do what's all in our power to do, and then either trust in, you know, trust in the as what the founders did when they put their trust in divine providence, or be ready for the judgment. Okay, that's mm-hmm. not a happy thing to see either.
Right.
Well, go ahead. As I said, there's only a couple minutes left, so go ahead, Tex. If you got anything about a minute to chime in on.
Yeah, I would just say that, you know, the two-party system, particularly at the top of this ticket, has just failed us. The Republican Party, which I've always believed in and been a part of, in a lot of ways, you know, I actually worked for it, so they cut me checks directly back in the day when I was in college. And Newt Gingrich inspired me to go to Washington, D.C., so I've always been a loyal GOP member and would never consider voting for another party until they pulled this. And I was like, if this is what the party is, this is not what the party said that it was about. And so if this is what it takes because it's Romney or nothing, then this isn't the Republican Party, and it has no principles anymore. This is the current Republican Party is just a whore looking for a buyer. So I got to go somewhere else at the top of the ticket. That's not to say there aren't good people in it. I'm down here in Texas. We have Ted Cruz, who's good, who I plan on supporting. But the top of this ticket is rotten, and the leadership of this party is rotten. And I think within the country, there is crying out people desiring a new choice apart from the two-party system. And, you know, maybe we don't win this one, but we cause the realignment so we can win the next one. You know, people are upset. They don't like what's happening. The country is in trouble. All of this stuff that we've been doing for the past 50, 60 years, that's all possible if the country is wealthy and doing well, right? Well, the country is getting close to bankruptcy. It's not doing well. Standards of living are not rising, and people are upset. So they're looking for a choice. And to the extent you guys offer a choice, that's excellent. And I would tell you another thing. Don't compromise on your principles, because look at what Gary Johnson did. Compromise on his principles, and now where is he? You know, he was a third-party candidate, and now he just shot himself in the foot.
And with that being said, unfortunately, I have just about a minute and a half, so unfortunately I'll have to take this to close things out. I'd like to thank both Floyd and Paul for coming in tonight. As I said, I'd offer, if we'd like to continue this conversation, if we can maybe schedule something, if you have time, maybe we can continue another time, another date. I'm sure the audience and everyone here on the panel would enjoy that. And I want to thank everyone who called in tonight, everyone on the panel. Rex,
Robert,
Tech. Yes, Chris.
These guys are both members on my group. Do you want me to post the link so people can, you know, be chatting with them off and on as we move on?
Sure, definitely. Leave it in the chat because chat's going to close down in about 30 seconds. So I'd go ahead and do that. So thanks everyone for coming in, the listeners, all those who are going to be listening on the archive as well. Thank you for listening to all the show. Everyone, take care and have a good night. Hope to talk to everyone again.
And I will leave the way I do in every show tonight, even though the folks won't be able to hear a little bit of it, but it is the song from Aubrey Ashburn, and it's a good way to bring everyone down from the high they've been for the show. And here we go, and everyone have a good night and take care.